From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, leading the fight against apartheid in the South African Parliament, we talk with Helen Suzman about her 36 years in the South African Parliament. For 13 years, she was the Parliament's only opponent of apartheid. Also, what is the role of Israel's peace movement now that the country has entered into a peace accord with the PLO? We'll talk with Amos Oz, a founder of the Israeli group Peace Now, and one of his country's leading novelists. And commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews two new novels that are sequels to literary classics. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court is making it easier for people to prove on-the-job sexual harassment. In a unanimous ruling, the High Court revived the case of a Tennessee woman, Teresa Harris, who accused her former boss of repeated verbal sexual harassment. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Harris lost her sexual harassment case in the lower courts because a judge ruled she had not shown she was psychologically harmed. Today, the Supreme Court unanimously reversed that judgment and sent the case back to the lower courts for reevaluation using a new standard. Writing for the court, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said that the federal civil rights law bars harassing conduct before it leads to a nervous breakdown. Rather, she said, the person who is suing must show an objectively hostile or abusive environment based on gender, or one that a reasonable person would find hostile or abusive. The High Court instructed the lower courts across the country that in evaluating whether an environment is hostile or abusive, they should look at all the circumstances, including the frequency of the discriminatory conduct and whether it unreasonably interferes with an employee's work performance. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
The Justice Department said today that a federal prosecutor appointed by President Clinton has removed herself from the investigation of a failed savings and loan association in Arkansas. The statement said that Paula Casey, a Clinton appointee, asked that she and her aides be recused from the case because they were familiar with some of the parties involved. Casey said she wanted to ensure that there were no misperceptions about the impartiality of the investigation. Casey was a volunteer on the Clinton presidential campaign. Republicans in the House said today that the Banking Committee should investigate the failed savings and loan. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has begun the search for a new deputy one day after Clifton Wharton resigned from the number two spot at the State Department. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
In his letter of resignation, Wharton spoke about the many frustrations of the political process in Washington, and he complained about anonymous character attacks against government officials, including himself. Wharton came to the State Department from the private sector. Secretary Christopher is said to want a deputy who will play a more active role than Wharton did. Christopher has begun asking former secretaries of state and others in the foreign policy community about candidates for the job, according to department spokesman Mike McCurry.
I think the secretary is determined to find someone who's got a wide range of foreign policy experience, a sophisticated understanding of the department itself, and someone who can contribute in a very critical way to his senior team.
McCurry said Christopher will proceed very deliberately because it's an extremely important position. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The Dow Industrials lost nearly 8 points today. This is NPR. The Supreme Court ruled today that school districts can be forced to pay to place a disabled child in private school if the district itself can't provide the child with an adequate education. The case involves a South Carolina couple who pulled their daughter out of a public high school and placed her in a private academy because they felt the school district couldn't provide the special education she needed. The school district opposed paying for the private academy because it wasn't certified to teach special education under federal law. The Senate is working its way through more than 200 amendments to the anti-crime bill as lawmakers attempt to ease voter anxiety about violent crime. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Judiciary Committee Chairman Joseph Biden says many of the amendments are simply designed to show the public how tough lawmakers can be on crime. He says he has no doubt an amendment to barbed wire the ankles of a jaywalker could pass. Lawmakers are so anxious to demonstrate their concern. While Biden was sarcastic, he also predicted that this year's anti-crime initiative would have a tremendous impact on law enforcement's efforts to control violence. Members are considering a wide range of amendments, from bans on assault weapons to making carjackings a crime punishable by death. But what many consider to be the most important provisions, funding for more police and more prisons, have already been approved by both the House and Senate. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
There were indications today that the Clinton administration may be considering easing the sanctions imposed on China less than 3 months ago. The Associated Press quoted congressional sources who said administration officials have been briefing lawmakers' staff members on the issue. The sanctions were imposed after China violated an international arms control agreement. The penalties, which were intended to remain in effect for 2 years, ban the sale of high-technology equipment to China. Sources said the administration is under pressure from U.S. businesses to ease the sanctions. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Helen Suzman has spent her life working within the South African political system to change her country's racist policies. She was a member of parliament for 36 years, from 1953 to 1989. For 13 of those years, she was the only member that opposed apartheid. Now that apartheid is being dismantled, she's written a book about her life fighting the system, called In No Uncertain Terms. Earlier today, she told me she was hopeful that South Africa can achieve democracy. The first multiracial elections will be held in April. I asked her what South Africans will be voting on.
Well, there will be a new constitution, interim one, actually, which will be put before them, which will contain also a Bill of Rights, which we've never had before. And the whole electoral system, of course, is being changed now because there's adult universal franchise for every adult citizen, irrespective of race, which is a first as well in South Africa. And they will be voting for a new government based on those concepts.
What do you think the racial makeup of the new government is likely to be?
Oh, I think without a doubt it'll be dominated by the African National Congress, which, as you know, is the major black organization with a number of white members, but it's mainly black. And since the voting public will be something like 21 to 22 million people, of whom 16 million, 14 to 16 million, none of these statistics are quite accurate, will be black. I think it inevitably is going to be an ANC-dominated government. But since it's proportional representation, it does mean that other parties, smaller parties, and the government, which is estimated to have about 20% of the vote, will also have representation in that parliament. And indeed, if they get enough pro rata votes on the proportional representation election, then they will even have a seat in the cabinet.
Do you have any reservations about a government that is likely to be run by people who have never been in government before?
No, because that would mean we'd have to go back to the old system where people are disfranchised simply because of their race or color. And I've been fighting that all my life. So obviously I'm very pleased to see the reform movement take hold and in fact begin to look as if it's actually going to come about.
Do you know a lot of white people who supported apartheid and are now talking about leaving the country?
Well, they talk, but whether they go or not is another matter. I've heard a lot of talk, but quite honestly, I've never met anybody who's actually in the process of leaving. It's not so easy to go anymore. First of all, other countries have got recessions, economic recessions, and unless one has the special expertise which that country happens to want, it's very difficult to come into a country as an immigrant, unless you have got close relatives there, a son, a mother, a father, or you happen to have, for instance, British citizenship because of your father or grandfather having been born in Britain.
As South Africa heads closer toward democracy, township violence has actually been on the rise. Is there a way that you can explain that for us?
Well, I think in a transitional period, there's always trouble. I mean, nothing is going to be an easy ride to democracy when you've had over four decades of an oppressive system dominated by a white minority, and you've had states of emergency. You've had a number of laws which have undermined the rule of law and due process, allowing people to be detained without trial and so on. So, I mean, quite obviously, it's not going to be an easy transition. Also, of course, there are factions among the black people themselves that are competing for power. It's a very valuable prize that people are going for, the government of the South Africa. And so there are competing elements there. There's a tribal element that comes in, an ethnic element, such as the rivalry between the Zulus in the Inkatha movement of Chief Minister Buthelezi of KwaZulu and Nelson Mandela's African National Congress. And there's a very militant left-wing section, the Pan-Africanists, who are also competing for some place anyway in the government. And, of course, apart from the National Party, which has been in government all this time, there is a far-right group of white people, reactionaries, who certainly do not want to change the status quo of white domination. So it's a pretty turbulent scene, and this has led to violence. But apart from the political violence, there's the criminal violence. And that has largely come about because of increased unemployment and poverty, to a large measure caused by sanctions and South Africa's losing her export markets in the labor-intensive sectors of our economy. And those, of course, are occupied largely by black people.
You're a longtime ally of the African National Congress, and yet you've been critical recently of the ANC for instigating violence. In 1992, you even criticized Amnesty International for not citing the ANC for violence. What kind of violence are you referring to?
Well, I don't like disinformation, and the Institute of Race Relations, of which I happened to be president at that time, I no longer am. I had 2 years, and that was the term of office, published a little booklet by an expert on the subject, and it was there were many complaints about it, because she stated that both Amnesty and the Human Rights Commission in South Africa were giving information which was not accurate. I mean, they simply blamed everything on the Inkatha movement and exonerated the African National Congress, and that really was not true.
Were you uncomfortable about criticizing a longtime ally like the ANC?
No, I think it's silly not to criticize when you think that people are doing the wrong thing. I mean, I'm a friend of Nelson Mandela's, have been since 1967 when I visited him first on Robben Island, long before he was the world's most famous political prisoner. But if I think Nelson Mandela has said something I don't agree with, I tell him so. He doesn't get annoyed about it. He accepts it. We argue about it. I argued with him originally when he was in favor of nationalization. He no longer is, not because of my arguments, but because he's had many businessmen tell him there'll be no investment in the country if he pursues that line of reasoning. I don't agree when he says he thinks 14-year-olds should be given the vote, and I tell him so. And so it goes on. I don't like his link with the Communist Party, and I have told him so. I mean, one must criticize. Surely you don't just accept everything people do because you happen to have been on the same side in a big fight against injustice.
Now, I should mention here that Nelson Mandela wrote the foreword to your new memoir.
Yes.
And my guest is Helen Sussman, and she was for years a dissident voice in the South African parliament, a voice against apartheid. She was in the parliament from 1953 to 89. And she's written a memoir called In No Uncertain Terms. You retired from Parliament in 1989. Does part of you really wish that you could be in Parliament in the new government that's elected in April?
Well, in a way, sometimes when I read things are happening that I'd like to stand up and talk about and argue about and criticize, I am quite sorry that I'm not there. On the other hand, I've had 36 years of active parliamentary work. I am now, alas, 76 years of age, and there are times when people must just get out and let younger people take over.
It's interesting because you were in Parliament opposing apartheid, and now that that system is ending and hopefully a new democracy, a new democratic era is about to begin, you won't be in Parliament to participate in it.
No, but there I am on the outside keeping a beady eye on everything. Really rather pleased that I've lived long enough to see what I never expected to see.
Did you never expect to see it?
No, I honestly didn't. I thought, and I still think, the government could have stayed in power for quite a long time and maintained the status quo. At a cost, of course, a cost of the economy running even further down, at the cost of escalating black resistance, which had already reached very high levels, and at the cost of more violence, all that. But, you know, if you've got the army and you've got the police force on your side, you can hold the situation, as we saw with Yeltsin and Moscow not too long ago.
So why do you think that, since the government didn't absolutely have to change right now, why do you think it did?
Well, I think the new state president who took over at the end of 1989 from P.W. Botha had decided that apartheid had failed and that a new era had to begin for South Africa. I think they were all very late in making this decision. But nevertheless, it's been made, and that's very good. And it was because of the economy. I do not deny that sanctions played a part in expediting the end of the apartheid system, but at dire cost of thousands upon thousands of jobs. And you know how important jobs are in every country in the world. Every candidate talks about creating jobs for his constituents, and it's no different in South Africa. And, of course, that's the reason for the violence, which is upsetting a lot of people, and that's really the reason why a lot of people are talking anyway about wanting to leave.
So you think sanctions had something to do with
it? Oh, yes, I don't deny
and
that.
You opposed sanctions.
Yes.
If you had it to do over again, would you not oppose economic sanctions?
I would oppose economic sanctions because I think the cost was too high in a country that has no social welfare support system, no dole, no food stamps. And if you lose your job, unless you were in a skilled occupation where you contributed to an unemployment insurance fund, you get nothing. And that is why the crime has increased so terribly. I think the apartheid system would have broken down anyway because of black resistance and because of South Africans did not like the isolation from sport and cultural events in the world. And also simply because the apartheid system no longer could be maintained. You cannot maintain segregation in an integrated economy. And all these were reasons why it broke down.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Helen Suzman. For 36 years, she was a member of the South African Parliament, a very strong voice against apartheid. She's written a new memoir called In No Uncertain Terms. We're going to take a short break, and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Helen Suzman. We're talking about her 36 years as a member of the South African Parliament, and that's the subject of her new memoir, In No Uncertain Terms. Now, you had two young children when you first ran for Parliament in 1953.
Yes.
And serving in Parliament required you spending 6 months away from home so that you could be where the Parliament was. It was far away from where you lived. It must have been a very hard decision to run. Why did you decide to do it?
Well, I actually had decided not to do it. And then my husband, who was very supportive in my political career, said, but you should do it. It's the logical outcome of what you've been doing all these years, which was a lot of work in the background in politics and teaching economic history at the university. The girls were 10 and 13 when I went into Parliament. They weren't exactly infants. I had a resident physician in my husband at home, and grandparents who looked after the setup as well. But it was hard, harder on them really than on me. I was very lucky because at least the girls were healthy most of the time. They weren't sickly children. And they were very preoccupied with school and sport and music and so on. And you know, there is an air service in South Africa, and I used to fly home every second weekend and sort of try to fix any domestic crises that had arisen.
You were elected to Parliament just 5 years after apartheid was codified by the National Party, just 3 years after the Racial Classification Act. So this repressive system had just been put into place in an official way. What did you see as your role as the lone voice of dissent?
Well, I only became the lone voice of dissent some years after I entered Parliament because I started as a member of the official opposition, which was the United Party, General Smuts's party, though he himself was dead by then. And we left the party there were 11 of us backbenchers who didn't like the equivocal way in which the United Party was fighting apartheid. and we left and formed our own party in 1959. And then there was a snap election in 61 after Dr. Verwoerd had taken South Africa out of the Commonwealth and declared an independent republic. And all my colleagues lost their seats at the 61 election with the exception of myself. And that sad story repeated itself in two subsequent elections in 1966 and 1970. And then in 1974, we got back six of our original members.
So for 13 years, you were the only voice of dissent. Did everybody in Parliament feel like your enemy? I mean, were they unfriendly to you as well as your political opposition?
Some people were quite friendly. They sort of liked me despite my views, but most of them really were very unfriendly. I mean, I never had a meal with any of my colleagues during those years. I used to go upstairs and have a meal upstairs with my secretary and researcher, or I used to have guests in the public dining room at Parliament, but I never sat down with my caucus, with the caucus people of the National Party or the United Party.
Were you ridiculed within Parliament for being anti-apartheid or for being female or for being Jewish?
Well, a bit of all of that, but ridiculed is not quite the word. I was attacked, and that's rather different. It was much more aggressive than ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, let's say being a woman didn't make any difference to me. I mean, I reckoned, you know, I knew that if you wanted to be considered the equal of male colleagues, you had to be better than them. And let me tell you, that wasn't that difficult. And as far as being Jewish is concerned, well, you know, that depended on the way Israel behaved at United Nations, funnily enough. You know, if United Nations voted against South Africa at UN, then at least if Israel voted against South Africa resolution at UN, then I used to come in for a lot of anti-Semitic interjections. On the other hand, after Israel won the Six-Day War, I was treated as a heroine, almost as if I'd done it myself, because the government identified with Israel as a sort of small country surrounded by dark-skinned neighbors, and there was this amazing Six-Day victory.
How did you keep getting re-elected to Parliament, having a minority point of view amongst the voting white population?
Well, the sort of constituency that I represented for 36 years was what you would call a silk stocking district. In other words, professional people, educated people, upper middle class people. They never were in competition for jobs with blacks. We could never win a seat in a blue collar area or even in the rural areas, which are very reactionary in South Africa. But, well, I started out with just a very small majority against the United Party then, not against the Nationalists. We were accused of splitting the opposition because we'd left the United Party, and that's why all my colleagues lost their seats.
You left them because they weren't vocal enough in their opposition to apartheid?
Well, they were very equivocal. They said that the policy was for economic integration but against social and political integration. And we were for integration, so that there was this constant row going on in the caucus with the small body of liberally minded people arguing with the majority in the caucus that we had to oppose laws which in fact were introducing social segregation and political segregation. So we had many rows, and in the end we walked out. Well, I was re-elected because, let me tell you, I was a good MP. I really was. I mean, I worked hard. I was very conscientious. I reported back to my constituents every year. I believe in accountability between constituents and Member of Parliament. I had my name in the phone books. I was available if anybody wanted either help or to complain about something I had done. And I made a lot of good speeches, which were really well reported in the English medium press. I got great coverage. Without them, I certainly could not have survived.
You know, I'm thinking about all the incredible repression that you were trying to fight, the murders of activists, the totally inhumane imprisonment of blacks, and especially of blacks who were leaders of the opposition. And yet you had to voice your opposition in this very kind of genteel setting, the Parliament. And granted, I know people were, you know, very vocal in arguing with each other, but still it's kept with argument. I mean, this is the kind of thing people fight to the death over. You know what I mean? This is the kind of thing that people put their lives on the line for. And I'm wondering if it was ever frustrating to be dealing with such incredible repression and oppression, to be dealing with the people responsible for it, and to only be able to argue with them.
Well, I mean, short of taking a gun and shooting them, what else could one do? I mean, it was an opportunity at least to voice one's utter despair and dismay at what the government was doing, and knowing that this would probably be printed in the press the next day, and keep some values alive in that country. Otherwise, the whole thing was just a morass of, as you say, oppressive legislation and people being ill-treated without anybody even knowing about it. So it had its value. It, strangely enough, the government, for all its authoritarianism, had a very healthy respect for the parliamentary system, which was why I, who was known to be opposed to everything, was given very adequate time to debate.
Mm-hmm. Your children, when they grew up, left the country. Did you expect that to happen?
I wasn't surprised. First of all, I mean, they lived in an atmosphere of hearing me constantly railing about how awful things were. So that didn't encourage them to think the future would be better. But also they both, in fact, had professions which would, I think, require, international experience. My one daughter is an art historian, and obviously the great galleries are not in South Africa. And the other daughter is a specialist in nephrology, kidney diseases, and she could certainly have practiced at home, but she decided that she would come to America, and she's practicing in Boston.
Do you get to see each other much?
Well, we're lucky, you know. We're unlike the Jews of the old diaspora who left Russia and Lithuania like my father did and never saw his parents again. We are able to travel and able to bring them out to see us. So that's, you know, very fortunate.
Why did your father leave, one of the pogroms of Eastern Europe and go to South Africa?
It's a question I often asked him.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know South Africa well, but for instance, in the United States, there are so many Jews who are descended from people who left the Eastern European pogroms, but you don't think of them as having headed to South Africa.
Well, a lot did come to South Africa. When I say a lot, nothing compared to the millions who came to the U.S., of course. But, you know, South Africa was considered a country of great promise at the turn of the century. Gold and diamonds had been discovered. The place was doing well. The Anglo-Boer War had ended, and it looked like a possibly good place for a young Jew. My father was 17, didn't have a penny to his name when he came to South Africa, couldn't speak either language, couldn't read English. Or Afrikaans, for that matter. So he had a difficult time, but he was a very energetic man with a great deal of stamina, which I've inherited. And he was a very intelligent man, and he did well. And he always, when I said to him in my really despairing moments, honestly, Pa, why didn't you go to America? And he'd say, don't be ridiculous. South Africa's the best country in the world. He wasn't particularly concerned about the rights of black people.
So you must have had a lot of disagreements with him.
Many, but, we were fond of each other, and if I could make him laugh, the argument generally ended in him offering me a scotch and soda.
Well, I want to thank you so much for telling us a little bit about your life, and thank you very, very much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Helen Sussman has written a new memoir called In No Uncertain Terms. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Amos Oz is one of Israel's leading novelists. He's also a longtime peace activist. But he writes that a dove must be hawkish about holding the Palestinians to the letter and spirit of the peace accord. Coming up, we talk with Oz about the role of peace activists now that there's a peace accord. Also, the characters of two literary classics have been revived in new novels. Maureen Corrigan reviews sequels to Sherlock Holmes and Pride and Prejudice. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The White House and Ross Perot traded jabs today as they prepared for tonight's political theater, a live 90-minute debate on NAFTA on The Larry King Show. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
The White House is describing tonight's debate as a battle of facts versus fear. Ross Perot, who has called the White House decision to debate him an act of desperation, said, "This is not a Super Bowl. We're talking about the jobs of millions of Americans." The vice president was preparing for the debate at his residence. Meanwhile, the president continued to call lawmakers one by one to lobby them for votes. He spoke to a group of business leaders today, urging them to call their Congress members and tell them that NAFTA would be good for ordinary Americans. The White House announced today that it had picked up the support of five additional House members. Opponents of NAFTA, meanwhile, claim they have already reached the 218 votes they need to kill the pact. The Perot-Gore debate will air at 9 p.m. tonight on CNN and on many national public radio stations. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Capitol Hill, in advance of a vote next week in the House on the North American Free Trade Agreement, the House Ways and Means Committee has approved the measure. Supporters of the agreement say it will aid the economies of all three nations involved, but opponents say that it means a loss of U.S. jobs to Mexico. In Los Angeles, the third of the original three defendants in the Reginald Denny beating case pleaded guilty today to a felony and two misdemeanors. During last year's riots, Antoine Miller was videotaped opening the door to Denny's big rig just before others brutally beat the trucker. From Los Angeles, NPR's Renee Montaigne reports.
Though Antoine Miller was originally charged with attempting to murder Denny, along with defendants Damian Williams and Henry Watson, he was never viewed as central to that crime. But Miller was also charged with attacking other motorists who happened into the intersection of Florence and Normandy the night the riots began. And today, the single felony to which Miller pleaded guilty was an assault on a woman Miller struck with a piece of metal. His crime against Denny was reduced to misdemeanor theft. As part of a plea bargain with prosecutors, Miller has already served his prison time, the year and a half he spent in jail while awaiting trial. The resolution of Antoine Miller's case leaves one last defendant facing charges in the attack on Denny. Lance Parker is accused of assault with a firearm and attempted arson for firing a shotgun at Denny's truck. In Los Angeles, this is Renee Montaigne.
The government says that wholesale prices fell last month, dropping 0.2%. The Labor Department says this drop came after an increase of 0.2% in September. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 8 points to close at 3,640.07 on volume of 276 million shares. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, at least 7 people were killed, including 3 school children, in mortar attacks on Sarajevo. Dozens of other people were wounded. It was the worst attack on the city in weeks. Apparently, a number of shells hit outside a school. The city has been under Serbian siege for more than a year and a half. Earlier today, a government-led evacuation of older citizens, women, and children was halted. Some 350 people were taken out yesterday. But UN officials say some 250 others were left behind. Meanwhile, in central Bosnia, a 16th-century stone bridge has been destroyed in Mostar. In factional fighting, up to 200,000 people are dead or missing, and more than 2 million people are homeless. A federal court judge ruled today that the Clinton administration should turn over a secret document produced by the White House Task Force on Health Care Reform. NPR's Patricia Naiman has more.
U.S. District Court Judge Royce Lamberth says the task force headed by Hillary Rodham Clinton has improperly withheld information. The task force, which was mandated to come up with a plan to reform the nation's health care system, was disbanded in late May. Even so, this ruling demands that the administration disclose whether certain task force participants were private citizens or government employees. If they were considered private citizens, then under law, their work must be made available to the public. Today's ruling comes in response to a lawsuit filed by public interest and health care groups. The judge also ordered the administration to produce information describing the deliberations of the 511-member task force and gave the White House 20 days to supply the information. White House officials say they will comply. I'm Patricia Naiman reporting.
In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Amos Oz is one of Israel's leading writers. He's illuminated his country's political and moral dilemmas in his novels and essays. Oz is also one of Israel's leading peace activists. He co-founded Peace Now. He's advocated a two-state solution, and he thinks that's the direction his country is now headed in. Oz is visiting the U.S. because his latest novel has just been published here. It's called FEMA. Earlier today, I asked him if the Israeli-PLO peace agreement is the breakthrough he's been hoping for.
This is no time for euphoria, and of course, the real hard work is still ahead of all of us. But an emotional and a cognitive breakthrough had been achieved. Even if the worst comes to the worst and there is a setback, a stalemate, even a break of the negotiation, the second handshake would never be as difficult as the first one. We'll never have to start from scratch.
What is the role of the peace movement now that a major step has been made toward peace?
Now, I think we are no longer a protest movement. It would be very silly for the Israeli peace movement to go on protesting each time we think Mr. Rabin is not making enough concession or not making them fast enough. I think this is time to become a bridge-building movement. Working on changing hearts and minds of many reluctant Israelis and Palestinians, engaging ourselves in a cultural and historical dialogue with the Palestinians over their feelings, their past, and ours. In short, it's time to educate, not to protest.
So how is this changing what you do?
Well, I do what I've always done. I talk to people. I go places, talk to people, listen to people. Sometimes record, sometimes write an article in the newspaper. I think some of the anger which motivated me in the past, some of the raving rage which made me write dashing articles is no longer there, and I can happily live without it.
Are there debates within Peace Now and the larger peace movement about what the next step should be?
Always have been. You don't get any two Israelis at all to agree on anything with each other. In fact, you hardly ever get one to agree with himself or herself. Everybody has a divided mind and soul on every issue. So, of course, we have heated debates along different lines. I think the key issue is how sympathetic are different members of Peace Now to the Palestinian cause. Whereas some has a degree of sympathy, some others, including myself, never regard themselves as pro-Palestinians. Pro-peace, yes. Make peace with the Palestinians because they are the enemy, not necessarily because they are nice, not necessarily because they have been our victims more than we have been theirs, and not necessarily because they are the nice guys in this clash. You make peace with the enemy, in my view, simply because this is the enemy, and no one has the privilege of choosing an enemy.
You've written that now doves must be hawkish about holding the new Palestinian government when it's formed in the areas of self-rule, holding them to the letter and spirit of the agreement.
Indeed. It's the Palestinians' turn to show that they can deliver. If they don't deliver, there will be no deal. And I'll be among the first one to say that, Israel should not make endless unilateral concessions. The Palestinians have to show that they can deliver Israel security and peace. It's a give-and-take deal. It's not a donation from the Israelis to the Palestinians.
You said before that you think it's the role of the peace movement now to be a bridge to reluctant Palestinians and Israelis, who are suspicious of the peace agreement. What do you think are the main suspicions on each side?
Well, you know, after 100 years of a bitter, deadly conflict, a conflict essentially over who is going to go away, who is going not to be there, it is very difficult for the parties to have any trust in each other. The Israelis have lived for two generations, really, under a collective Salman Rushdie experience. There has been a death verdict issued on the whole of Israel by Islamic fundamentalist leaders and by Arab politicians. It is only natural that the Israelis are untrusting and suspicious. The Palestinians, for their part, have to undergo a major change. They have been trained for generations to think that Israel is a nightmare. If they only rub their eyes hard enough, it will go away. Or perhaps that Israel is a mobile exhibition that can be transferred elsewhere. They will have to change. It's difficult. It's a hard moment for both sides.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Israeli novelist and peace activist Amos Oz. His new novel is called FEMA. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Amos Oz is my guest. He's visiting from Israel. He has a new novel called FEMA. Amos Oz is also a founder of Peace Now. Do you feel that you're undergoing some kind of psychological readjustment after having seen Arafat shake hands with Rabin? I mean, were you expecting something like that? Do you see him differently than you did before?
That's besides the point, you know. How I feel about Arafat is irrelevant. I don't.
Why is that irrelevant?
Because you don't have to like an enemy in order to make peace with him. I am no Jane Fonda, and Arafat is not my Ho Chi Minh. And I don't think anything in the world will make me endorse Arafat or the Palestinian National Movement as it had been so far. I think it's one of the most uncompromising national movements of all times. I think it had brought a heavy disaster upon its own people. But I say this is besides the point because there is no question of endorsing the PLO. There is a question of making peace and coexistence. It's for the sake of life, not for the sake of love.
As you've written, both Israel and the Palestinians still disagree about the past and the meaning of the past. Is it possible to create a real and lasting peace while the meaning of the past is still disputed?
Absolutely. This is the way life is, not only between nations, between individuals. There is no need at all to agree on the narrative of the past, on who is to blame, on who started it all, on who was David and who was Goliath in this business, in order to create a future. We have to create a certain future in which we can stop dying and start living. That's all that is there. I mean, the rest is sentimentality. This is a tragic clash between two very powerful claims. And there is no way the Israelis will ever go down on their knees telling the Palestinians, oh, brothers, how could we do such a terrible thing to you, or the Palestinians, to the Israelis. We are doomed and destined to live with two narratives. Now, I'm a storyteller, I'm a novelist, and I know very well that this is the way it's in my novels, and this is the way it is very often in human affairs.
You've written that the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians has been a tragic one. But the relationship between Israel and Iran or Syria, that's not tragic. What's the difference? What's the distinction that you're making there?
Well, the Iranians want to throw the Israelis into the ocean for fanaticism and hatred. The Palestinians have no other homeland, and we have no other homeland. There is a tragedy for you, a clash between right and right. The clash between Israel and Syria is a clash between right and wrong. Israel is right and Syria is wrong. It's as simple as that. Or between Israel and Libya. Or between Israel and Iraq. Israel is right and the aggressors are wrong. It is different with the Palestinians. It's right versus right, and this is the one which intrigues me most and fascinates me most. This is what I write about in my novels. This is what I deal with. I've always been writing about the clash between one very powerful case and another. And as a writer, as a novelist, I'm in the business of sympathizing with two or three or five conflicting and contradicting claims. This provides for a tragedy, but believe me, it also provides for a certain comedy.
Well, have you? Do you feel you've been able to find the comic aspects of the long dispute between Israel and the Palestinians?
Well, certainly in my latest novel, in FEMA, I have dealt with the comical side of tragic experiences, including the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It is a novel about a man who is obsessed with politics, overwhelmed by politics, eats and drinks and sleeps politics, and yet it's not a novel about politics. It's a novel about obsession. Obsession is funny, always, when watched from the outside.
This is also about a man who might be obsessed with politics, but he doesn't do anything about it.
Yes, he's not a doer. He is a thinker. He's a good man who can do very little good, a giver who has very little to give, a great lover of women who is not very good at satisfying women in any way, a great lover of the universe, a man who is in a perpetual dialogue with street cats and stones, a great educator of every taxi driver in Jerusalem, an enthusiastic giver, and yet a man at the same time, a man who is unable to tie his own shirt, to button his own shirt. So here is the tragedy and the comedy in one.
Does FEMA represent to you a larger group in Israel?
You know, I'm no sociologist. I'd have written the same book even if the sociologist had proven to me that there are no FEMAs at all in Israel. But I do have a certain hunch that not only in Israel, even here in this blessed America, this character of an ineffective, sweet intellectual, the good man whose kitchen is a mess and whose life is a mess and whose love affairs are a mess, who is forever paralyzed by seeing both sides of each dilemma, who is the compromiser who would like to satisfy everybody and make everyone happy, who, having to choose between tea and coffee, would apply for a mixture of the two because he wouldn't like to insult either tea or coffee. They are both very nice. I think this type is not entirely unfamiliar even in this country.
Well, I think you must be right. by the way, I was wondering if his political views are shared by you.
Well, yes, I'm very close to many of his political manifestations, although he is a lot more flamboyant and fiery than I am, and perhaps epiphanic. And yet when I wrote the novel, I was tongue-in-cheek about his politics and indeed about my own politics.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Amos Oz, and he's one of Israel's leading novelists and also a co-founder of Peace Now. He has a new novel called FEMA. You've written that you think there's a double standard that Western intellectuals have about Israel and the Palestinians and their use of violence. Let me get you to elaborate on that.
Well, I think there is a certain inclination among well-meaning people in the West to be more morally forgiving or more forgiving toward the Third World than they are toward Israel, or than they are toward any allegedly Western country. By the way, Israel is not a Western country. The majority of the Israelis are people of Middle Eastern and Oriental extraction. There is a certain inclination to give the Third World a moral discount for the past suffering and humiliation. In fact, I believe no one deserves a moral discount. Decency, yes. Help, material help, definitely, yes. Equal treatment, yes. But no moral discounts, ever. And I think it is very unrealistic to expect the Palestinians, or to understand the Palestinians and the other Arabs' violence against the background of their past suffering, and at the same time to assume that the Jews, having suffered so much, should become nonviolent. This is almost, I'd say, giving hypocrisy a bad name.
So you think in the eyes of a lot of Western intellectuals, the oppression of the Palestinians legitimizes their sometimes violent tactics, whereas the oppression and attempted genocide of the Jews is used to say, well, how can you people in Israel ever use violence after what you've been?
That's it, more or less. The Palestinians have got to understand they have suffered a great deal. They have been persecuted and oppressed. It's only natural that they get violent. The Israelis, the Jews, on the other hand, having been through hell themselves, how can they be violent after such a terrible experience? Now, this is really giving a double standard a bad name. But it has a deep and complex background, which is to some extent dealt with in my novel. FEMA is very excessive about the relations between Jews, Israelis, and certain Western critics of Israel, especially against some simplistic Christian expectations from Israel to become the Jesus Christ of the nations, forever turning its other cheek to the enemy. This is very much one of the topics which are on Fima's mind and which are interwoven into the novel, again in a rather funny way.
Mm-hmm. You know, the conflict between Israel and Palestinians has been going on for so long, it's the kind of thing that you think, well, maybe it won't ever end, you know? Maybe this is just going to go on. Did you expect that progress would be made?
Yes, I didn't have the timetable. But I did expect, in fact, Fima in my novel, as early in 1989, he fantasizes, he has a cabinet, he presides as prime minister over a fantasy cabinet inside his own head, and he fantasizes about talking to the PLO and proposing Mr. Arafat to take control over Gaza first. Now, I have to admit, although I shared the perspective, when I wrote it for Fima, I was a bit tongue-in-cheek. I thought, okay, he's a naive idealist and so on. Now it turns out that he was not only ahead of politicians and ideologists, this is not such a big deal to be ahead of politicians and ideologists, he was ahead of his creator, he was ahead of me, which perhaps shows we should never belittle the fools, not even the fools we ourselves create.
Amos Oz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Amos Oz has written a new novel called Fima. This is Fresh Air. The Vice President and Ross Perot will debate NAFTA tonight. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you be doing on NAFTA on All Things Considered?
Well, we're going to look at what you ought to know for sure as you look at that debate on NAFTA tonight. We will have Andy Bowers picking apart the NAFTA ads, telling us what's real and what isn't, and we'll talk to an undecided member of Congress about the various blandishments he's receiving from all sides, attempting to convince him. Also, a new biography of W.E.B. Du Bois, the activities of missionaries, Seventh-day Adventists, that work in Russia, and the Supreme Court has changed and broadened the definition of sexual harassment.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We've been seeing the trend lately toward movies that are lavish sequels to old TV classics, like Dennis the Menace, The Addams Family, The Beverly Hillbillies, and the forthcoming Flintstones. The publishing world has been doing the same. Scarlett O'Hara, Sherlock Holmes, and Mrs. Maxim de Winter are all materializing in local bookstores in somewhat altered states. Maureen Carrigan has a review of two successful sequels.
The creatures that emerge from most literary sequels usually end up looking more like Frankenstein's monster than they do their old selves. Sure, the essential body parts are there, but a reader can't help but be distracted by all those big bolts and sloppy stitches that hold the production together. But sometimes literary sequels are more than just clumsy copies of the originals. In her new novel, Sherlock in Love, author Sina Jeter Naslund has discovered the secret of creative animation. She assembles odd fragments from the Conan Doyle stories and then takes the liberty of adding some modern feminist flourishes. The result is a surprisingly moving mystery that's also one of the most believable Holmes and Watson spin-offs I've ever seen in print or on film. Sherlock in Love opens with this awful announcement from Dr. Watson. To begin with, Holmes was dead, and had been dead for well onto 2 years. And who was I without Holmes? It's a December evening in 1922, and the elderly Dr. Watson is sitting alone in the gloom of number 221B Baker Street. To ease his grief, Watson has decided to write Holmes's biography. But when he places an ad in the London Times asking for other friends of Holmes to contact him, sinister things begin happening. Watson's journals are razored to shreds, and he's threatened by an evil Holmes twin and by the infamous woman in red, Irene Adler. Out of desperation, Watson assumes the unfamiliar role of detective. What he discovers convinces him the terrible secret of Sherlock Holmes's life must never be divulged. There are clever tales within tales here, featuring angry suffragists, a stolen Stradivarius, and Mad King Ludwig of Bavaria. But the simple story that frames all the others is the most haunting. It's the story of old Dr. Watson trying to restore his dear friend Holmes to life by writing about him. By the end of Sherlock in Love, even the most skeptical of Naslin's readers will believe such miracles can happen. A just-published sequel to Pride and Prejudice, entitled Presumption, is not quite as dazzling, but it lives up to the modest promise of its subtitle, An Entertainment. The first chapters of Presumption update us on the fates of two of literature's most beloved heroines, the Bennet sisters. Elizabeth is now semi-happily married to that moody Mr. Moneybags, Fitzwilliam Darcy. Jane is becoming adept at playing dumb in order not to outshine her amiably foolish husband, Mr. Bingley. The rest of this sequel focuses on a minor character from Pride and Prejudice, Darcy's sister, Georgiana, who's now navigating her way through the perilous 19th century marriage market. Presumption was written by two women who jointly call themselves Julia Barrett. They share a talent for mimicking Austen's epigrammatic wit. For instance, describing Georgiana's conversation with an eligible bachelor, they write, "Georgiana rewarded him with that most brilliant of womanly rejoinders, rapt attention." Austen fans are an especially protective bunch, so they probably won't reward Presumption with quite so high a compliment. But they might well praise it by invoking that famous double-edged comment Austen once made about a social call. Austen wrote, "It was a delightful visit, perfect in being much too short."
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Presumption by Julia Barrett and Sherlock in Love by Sina Jeter Naslund. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landau. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Chris Fraley, and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the cinematic quality of violence. We talk with film director Brian De Palma about how and why he makes the movies he does. De Palma directed the films Carrie, Dressed to Kill, Scarface, and Casualties of War. His new one, Carlito's Way, stars Al Pacino. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.